loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at several big stories. In our first half an hour, we review the big news of the week so far. We'll talk about international and domestic issues, the possibility of a government shutdown, the mass protests in France, the possible redo of an election in North Carolina, and the status of the Farm Bill. And then, because it's Wednesday, we continue our regular Wednesday segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, was sentenced this afternoon to 36 months in a federal prison. He had earlier pleaded guilty to a number of felonies, what the judge called a smorgasbord of fraud. He apparently only partially cooperated with the Mueller investigation, but prosecutors told the judge that Cohen had been truthful. Next, Meng Wanzhou was arrested on December 1st at the request of the United States because her company, Huawei, allegedly is doing business with Iran, which is subject to U.S. sanctions. But she has now been released on bail by order of a judge in Canada. Then, lawmakers from Britain's Conservative Party called for a no-confidence vote today in a bid to oust Prime Minister Theresa May because of the Brexit deal she negotiated with the European Union. However, as of the time of this recording, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, a majority of Tory party members have said that they would support May. That's enough for her to win. But the future of her government is still in doubt. And then Turkish President Erdogan said today that his country would begin a new military offensive within days in northern Syria, quote, to clear the area of Kurdish rebels on both sides of the Euphrates River, unquote. Erdogan added that Turkey would specifically not target Americans in the area, but the move will almost certainly raise tensions with the United States. And finally, Israeli soldiers entered Ramallah yesterday, with low-level clashes breaking out only yards from the home of Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. The soldiers seized security footage from buildings in the area, and they raided the offices of Wafa, the Palestinian news agency. Meanwhile, a Palestinian child was killed in an earlier shooting, and a pregnant woman was gravely wounded. And in other headlines, China made major soybean purchases today for the first time in months since President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping escalated a trade war and China put retaliatory tariffs on the legume on July 6th. The multiple deals were valued at more than $180 million. Until this summer, China was the biggest buyer of U.S. soybeans, purchasing on average 60% of the country's production. Former Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro formed an exploratory committee to consider a run for president. Before serving in the Obama administration, Castro was the mayor of San Antonio. At 44 years old, Castro would be one of the youngest candidates in the Democratic primary. UN climate talks in Poland are ongoing as several nations work to decide how to keep jobs and maintain stability while phasing out coal. Reports are that the coal conversation is outweighing discussions about developing cleaner, renewable energy and low-carbon technologies. To meet needed levels laid out in a United Nations report in October, the world's coal use would need to come down from 30% of the world's electricity to under 2%. After having had their country's budget rejected by the European Union, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte today made an offer to the European Commission to lower Italy's deficit to 2.04% of gross domestic product, or GDP, by 2019. Conte said that additional financial resources had given Italy more room to negotiate their budget. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our new segment. Well, it's not brand new, but it's pretty new. It's called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. We're joined in studio by Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Thanks.
Happy to be here.
Again, we're going to have the week in review on Friday, but this is Wednesday. So let's talk about what's in the news. Certainly what is in the news, well, it was the big news last night, was the live TV exchange between Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi representing the Democrats in the Senate and in the House, and the President of the United States, Donald J. Jay Trump. And the question was about whether the Democrats would capitulate to Trump and fund a border wall, $5 billion more to build another wall. There's already a wall, a lot of fences at the border. And then it was about a government shutdown. Let's listen to this pretty remarkable live TV exchange between the three of them.
One thing I think we can agree on is we shouldn't shut down the government over a dispute. And you want to shut it down. You keep talking about it.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No.
And then you opened it up very quickly. And
20 times.
I don't want to do what you did.
20 times, Chuck, you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wool. None of us have
said. You want to know something?
You've said
it. Okay, you want to put that
on my... You said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And
we
I am
disagree.
Proud, and I'll
we
tell
disagree.
You what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle
Good.
Of shutting down.
That is
and I'm going to shut it down for border security.
But we
security.
Believe you shouldn't
okay.
shut it down.
But you're
Thank you very much, everybody.
All right, Jackie, go ahead.
Oh, my gosh. I hate it when the Democrats don't realize how well they're being played by this man. I really, they are just so, that was a perfect opportunity to really confront him with actual facts, with his own words. I mean, they could have said when he said, if we don't get our wall through, if we don't get what we want through you, through the military, they should have stopped him right there and said, what exactly do you mean by through the military? What is it that you want the military to do in regard to your wall? How are you going to empower the military to do something that they're not authorized to do ever? What do you mean? And then when he goes on about, you know, people who are criminals and who would, you know, pour drugs pouring into our border, they could have addressed those issues, that we have an opioid crisis that's fueled by the pharmaceutical industry in this country right now that has nothing to do with Latin America. So they had the perfect opportunity to refute his ridiculous tantrum with facts.
John Kiriakou, they didn't do that because they don't want to. But what they did do was they felt that they had a political advantage because they were going to be able to blame Donald Trump, who said, I own it now.
Yeah, Jackie's not wrong, but I don't think that they cared. I think that all they wanted to do was to talk him into a corner, which they did quite skillfully. And he took, I mean, you could see the smile on Chuck Schumer's face. He almost couldn't help himself but to smile when those words came out of Donald Trump's mouth that he'll take responsibility for the shutdown. Because, you know, this is a pissing match between Donald Trump and the Democrats. And the Democrats won yesterday because Donald Trump is so proud that he'll shut the government down now just because he said he would. And he has to make sure that he doesn't look weak. When that happens, the Democrats only have to sit back and say, see, I told you so.
The basis for the opposition to the shutdown is, you know, well, one of two things. It can be on the basis of it's bad for the functioning of the government. It makes it administratively inefficient. It costs money. It's, you know, just like bad for business as usual. Or you could challenge this like ridiculous demand for a border wall, right, which is really just sort of a metaphor for the whole, like war on immigrants that the Trump administration has been waging, which is not something that the Trump administration initiated, but they've certainly taken up the mantle of it and basically increased the sort of terroristic nature of it, right? It's become more random than it was under Obama, even though deportations are about where it was before and maybe even down a little bit. It's become more terroristic and it's become more fueled by like overt racist invective. And that's what the wall really is, right? I mean, it's just a metaphor, like we're going to keep all those people out because they're bringing in drugs and they're criminals. And, you know, like that's like a pretty outlandishly racist comment. And so the Democrats had a perfect opportunity to stand for like a political principle, right? That like immigrants aren't dangerous, bad people. But they didn't do that, right? They went the sort of procedural route, just like, well, this is going to be a big mess and it's going to be your responsibility.
Yeah, Walter's right. Everybody here is right on this, actually. And Jackie, when the Democrats allowed or really shut the government down last time, supposedly in defense of the DACA recipients, the Dreamers, within 24 hours, that backfired and they basically retreated and capitulated because the Republicans were able to say shutting down the government was the Democrats' fault, and the Democrats were focused on a narrow part of the population, immigrant kids who came here as youngsters, and their parents didn't have papers, and they still don't have papers, and that we, the American people, have been sacrificed because the Democrats prioritized the immigrants. That's how the Republicans pitched it.
Right.
And immediately the Democrats capitulated because it was, in fact, backfiring politically. So now the Democrats are really treating this purely as a political advantage because Donald Trump, they think, did something really, really bad by embracing the shutdown, which last time was unpopular. But what's Donald Trump's calculations? This wasn't off the top. Maybe he was angry. Maybe he was baited, as you were saying.
I think I know what Donald Trump's calculation was. I think that he believes that the American people really want this border wall. I think that's what
it
is.
Well, his supporters really want this border wall. He knows that.
Sure.
Yeah.
His supporters do. But I think he has a very short memory. He doesn't remember some of the longer shutdowns, like the shutdown of 95. I was working overseas at the American Embassy in Bahrain. And when all of a sudden you can't get a passport or your social security check doesn't come, people start to get angry. And then when somebody like Donald Trump stands up and says, I take full responsibility for the shutdown, well, then Donald Trump is going to be the target of their ire.
Yeah, and a lot of older civil servants, government workers, do remember that. I mean, my mom has since passed, but I remember that shutdown in 94. And, you know, after the first two or three days, it was like, okay, when are we going to go back to work? And then you had all of these, government employees angry, you know, because their government could not fund their jobs. And it was insane. So I agree with you on that Trump has really bad institutional. I don't even think it's institutional memory. He just doesn't know these things. He doesn't know and he doesn't care.
Let's go on to another story. This is our segment called In the News, where we take a look midweek on Wednesdays about what's in the news so far. On Friday, we'll also be joined by Jacqueline Lookman and Walter Spolarek for the Week in Review. That's our first hour on Friday where we'll review the big stories, domestic and international. Jackie, let's go on. I'm looking now at the New York Times. North Carolina fraud scandal cast shadow over the primary to December 12th, 2018. That story, is there going to be a new vote, a second vote, a new election in North Carolina for the House?
I think it's kind of inevitable now when you have stories about operatives literally hiding, holding on to hundreds of absentee ballots, going to people's houses and picking up absentee ballots and saying, I'm going to take them to the polling place and filling the ballots out for people. And I mean, the Republicans can oppose this all they want to, but if they keep opposing a new election, they're just going to look more corrupt than they already are. So I don't think they can avoid a new election here.
What's your take, John?
I think Jackie's right. They can't avoid a new election. This thing has fraud written all over it. And the interesting thing to me is this is not the Democrats accusing the Republicans. It's the Democrats and the Republicans accusing the really conservative Republicans.
Right, right.
The New York Times has a piece today that is just so fun to read if you're interested in things like voter fraud. This Republican insurgent, Harris, that defeated the Republican congressional incumbent, he only beat him by 828 votes. The Times says he had unusual success among absentee voters. And he did, because among absentees, he won 437 to 19. Okay. It's pretty dramatic.
And most of them were dead.
I wouldn't be surprised. 2 years ago, he ran and he lost absentees 226 to 4.
That's quite a sea change.
It's quite an incredible turnaround. So in all seriousness.
Like a phoenix rising from the ashes.
That's exactly what it is. Rising up from the ashes. The truth is that this insurgent, Harris, hired Republican consulting firm that is known for walking right on the edge of electoral fraud. And there's compelling evidence that they actually committed electoral fraud twice in the Republican primary and again in the general election.
Now, the Republicans are saying in North Carolina, yeah, we want to have a new general election, but they also want to have a new primary.
That's right.
So perhaps they can, if they get rid of Harris, then in a general election, have a better chance. Do you think that's their calculation?
Oh, yeah, it is the calculation.
Yeah, and also to raise money, too. I mean, it's not just sort of like this person having a tarnished image. You know, to run a whole new campaign means starting all over again in terms of raising money. And presumably the people who have given to Harris are already, you know, tapped out or close to tapped out. And so they need somebody else to just motivate. I mean, because, you know, elections aren't just about like people's opinions. It's also like there's like a threshold of money you have to get from rich people before you become a viable candidate. And so to get to that threshold of money, like they definitely need a new guy.
John, we were talking before the show. There have been other revotes in American history. You know of one.
Yeah, my favorite and the most recent was in 1974 in the New Hampshire Senate race, where the Democrat and the Republican actually tied with more than a quarter million votes cast. They tied. And of course, this thing worked its way through the courts. They had recount after recount, and still it was a tie. And so they had a revote. And then the Democrat, John Durkin, finally won that seat. He lost it 6 years later. But I mean, they did it as gentlemen would do it. You just, you know, everybody tries to remain as honest as possible, and then you just have a revote.
Yeah, this is a different scene in North Carolina.
Indeed it is.
Okay, these are not gentlemen.
Yeah. Let's move on. I mean, this was the week of the yellow vests. They came out again and again and again. And Macron, who said he would never surrender, surrendered at least in some important ways, providing economic reforms for the working class and for the poor.
And before Jackie and Walter comment on this, I want to add, too, that we're not the only ones watching this. The Egyptian government this week banned the sale of yellow vests because they're petrified that people are going to put them on and take to the streets in Cairo as well.
Yeah, there were people wearing yellow vests in Baghdad.
Oh, boy.
Walter, again, this is a remarkable movement. As our guest, Gilbert Mercier, said, these are not simply like the sort of middle class left students and workers from the 1968 rebellion, the general strike of France, which, of course, rocked France and rocked Europe and rocked the world. This is the revolt of the lower classes in general, the sans-culottes, meaning going back to the French Revolution. The movement has grown. It's expanded. Its demands have changed.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a fundamental difference when you have, you know, a spontaneous mass movement that arises outside of the existing institutions, whether they're left-wing political parties or left-wing trade unions, which are very large in France, and something that happens because, you know, there's a spark, and in this case, it was a tax on gasoline that was going to affect poor and working people the most. It was sold as an ecological tax. That's nonsense. It was just, you know, another way to punish people for being poor.
I don't mean to interrupt you, even though I am interrupting you, and I want you to continue. The U.S. media despicably characterized these people as hostile to environmental reform.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And if you look at the actual list of demands of the yellow vests, I mean, there's like lots of like pro-environment stuff in there. And so, you know, the Macron government surrendered pretty quickly on the issue of the tax. They sort of suspended it long term. It's effectively gone. But the movement has continued, and that's because it's become something that is addressing more fundamental injustices in French society and basically the whole direction that the French economy and government has been going, at least since, you know, the 1980s when Mitterrand, the sort of left-wing Socialist Party prime minister, president was in office. And, you know, the yellow vests are now inspiring other sectors. You know, there's a student rebellion basically already going on that has been sort of like infused with new energy. There's going to be the CGT trade union, a historically communist-led union that's also the largest in France, is calling for a day of action, I believe, tomorrow or on Friday. So it's something that's definitely going to be continuing.
Yeah, Jackie, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a fascinating story for me since it first took root. People mistakenly in you know, the American media especially, mistakenly just reduced this to the fuel tax issue. But the fuel tax was like the straw that broke the camel's back for the French working class. The Macron's government had implemented like a Patriot Act style type of security supposed legislation after the attacks in France a few years ago that people hated, that they didn't even vote on. Then he voted to tax he moved to tax pensions on he voted he wanted to tax retired people's pensions. How despicable is that?
What does he think, the French are Americans?
I mean, there was the fuel tax, but then there was the repealing of the wealth tax, which was an enormous blow. It was an enormous insult to French working people. And that happened before this fuel tax thing. And there were a lot of other measures in between that were really, he weakened union protections. So the working class in France have been feeling under siege by the Macron government for a long time.
The protesters, interestingly, they were demanding all kinds of economic demands for working class and poor people. They were also making demands for the rural and semi-rural areas. I mean, France has a unique culture. It has a culture whereby American-style corporations are not dominating,
right,
let's say, the sale of food or consumption. But that's starting to happen in rural and semi-rural France, and the historical part of French culture and businesses and class structures are being undermined. They're also demanding that the government not represent corporations, that the government do things that actually protect smaller businesses in rural and semi-rural areas. That's a big issue in France.
Yeah, and it's reflected in the demand. So like one of the demands is for free parking in city centers, right? So that you can, you know, go and shop and not have to spend all your money on parking. And there's demands with regards to the farm. So the gas tax, right, is actually especially bad for farmers because, you know, you use a lot of gas to operate the machinery that you need for your farm. For people who live in these small towns, they might actually still work in big cities. But because housing is so hugely expensive, you know, they have to live in these smaller towns that are far away and therefore, you know, use more gas. So, you know, in other words, it's sort of all of that is embedded into the political program of the Yellow Vests. And I think that, you know, the bloc that they represent society is, you know, like we were talking about earlier, certainly, you know, like the poor. But then also, you know, there are these like elements in the middle of society, right? Even though, you know, middle class is kind of this vague term, but, you know, people who are sort of in the middle, who are very concerned that their situation is not sustainable, right? That they could be sort of like impoverished at any moment because wealth is constantly being concentrated into the hands of the very richest.
Yeah. I mean, and another aspect of these protests, aside from the fact that how fast they're spreading to other countries, Belgium, Spain, the Netherlands, all over the place now, it's interesting that they are calling for an expansion of public transportation just for exactly what you said, Walter, to connect the rural pastoral areas with the cities. But also here in the United States, we have this thing where when people protest and someone breaks some windows, people say, oh, my God, if you commit violence, you know, we're not going to support your cause. Well, that's property damage. That's not violence, first of all. But apparently the people in France don't have a problem with supporting the cause of the Yellow Vests because some windows were broken.
I saw interviews with well-to-do people whose cars were set on fire. And while they were lamenting the loss of their car, they were saying, but of course, the government must address the issues of income inequality. I mean, it's different in France in terms mm-hmm. of how this is dealt with. Before we leave this issue, the cost of a gallon of gas in the United States right now, on average, is about $2.69. Anybody amongst our panel want to guess what the cost of gas is in France per gallon?
$5.
I can tell you what it is in Greece.
What is it in Greece?
It's $9 a gallon in Greece.
Yeah. Nine?
Okay, so
wow.
Greece is, they need yellow vests in Greece.
Very much yeah. so.
In France, it's $5.87 a gallon. If Americans had to double the price of gasoline right now, and if they were required by law to keep yellow fluorescent vests in their cars, they'd probably be putting those vests on and going into
Without
the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow, time goes fast. We have just about 3 minutes left. Jackie, you highlighted a story for us about the farm bill in the House of Representatives. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty fascinating story for me because I think for me, it points to how the GOP pits two groups of working people against each other using this piece of legislation. Like the farm bill is needed for farmers, right? And that's fine. And that's, we have no problems with that. We can argue about some of the merits of some of the legislation, but it's okay. It's for farmers. And we can also argue that the farm bill helps farmers produce, feeds people in need, feeds working Americans in need. That seems to be an easy argument, right? But that's never the argument the GOP uses. And this iteration of this farm bill is a great example because Paul Ryan tried to, and the GOP tried to put a whole bunch of restrictions on SNAP, supplemental nutritional assistance program, food stamps, basically, into the farm bill. And they were saying that's the only way we're going to pass this farm bill is if we basically
take away food stamps from
food stamps from poor people, because, you know, poor people are the devil and they're a drain on America, on the American
economy. And we don't
economy.
Want them to eat.
And
we don't want people to eat.
We do not want poor people to eat this food that these farmers produce. But that's not what happened. Nobody voted for these further restrictions. So this, instead of being this win for the GOP in cracking down on welfare recipients, it turned into a loss, and they're trying to spin this. But it's really interesting in a really morbid kind of way how the GOP and to some extent the Democratic Party, because they don't push back on this, how they are willing to sacrifice poor people, even poor working people, and their ability to eat for their sick political ideology, and they're willing to use farmers to do it.
Yeah, amazing. That's Jacqueline Lookman. Walter Smolarek, 1 minute left.
Yeah, I mean, society needs to develop a new conception of like what a right is. I mean, if you ask most people who are decent people, who are not people like Paul Ryan, like, hey, should everybody be able to eat? I mean, everybody would say, like, yeah, sure, absolutely. And I think the same argument could be applied to other things that are, like, you know, essentials for living a dignified life. So the right to healthcare, to education, to housing, food being the most basic of all of those things. I mean, you know, society needs to develop a conception of rights that goes beyond just the things that, you know, maybe the government is supposed to not do to us, right? Like infringe on the right to, you know, free speech or assembly or something like that. But there should also be affirmative rights. People should have the right to the basics and the necessities.
One of the sad things about this, too, is that as recently as the early 1990s, we never fought about the farm bill. We never fought about infrastructure bills. These were things that all members of Congress supported for the very reasons that Jackie has elucidated here. But it shows you how torn apart we are as a country, that we can't even get a simple farm bill through because of ideological reasons.
All right, we are out of time. This went fast.
We're
going to have Jacqueline Lookman and Walter Smolarek are going to join us again on Friday in our segment called The Week in Review. It's the first hour of Loud and Clear every Friday. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, energy waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined in studio by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and find out about the group by going to their website at beyondnuclear.org. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Welcome.
Thank you.
Kevin, gosh, I always think we covered so much territory in the last call, we'd have a diminished agenda in the next call. Not true. Where do you want to start?
The nuclear industry does not slow down, you know, it doesn't happen.
They keep coming at us. Well, one of the big stories from the past week is that the Trump administration, the Trump Department of Energy, has gotten out its Orwellian magic wand, and they are linguistically detoxifying high-level radioactive waste, calling it by a euphemistic name of waste incidental to reprocessing. In other words, low-level radioactive waste. In other words, leave it where it's at, in situ abandonment. They've gotten away with this in the past. This was under the George W. Bush administration. It was Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, who did the dirty work. This was one of the darkest days I've had in Washington, D.C. It was June 6th of 2004. And we lost on a tie vote in the U.S. Senate because we had to win by a majority. And we lost on a 48-48 tie. And they got away with this waste incidental to reprocessing in South Carolina at the Savannah River site. And they got away with it at Idaho National Laboratory. They did not get away with it at that time in Hanford, Washington, and West Valley, New York, and other places. But here they come. They have a public comment period. They're trying to limit it to 60 days. We got 76 groups saying we need more time than that. And now we've got until January 10th, I think it is, to make our comments as to why this is a bad idea.
So just to be clear, this is radioactive waste that they're deciding to call something less than radioactive waste in order to qualify it for kind of different handling?
I think that's what's called a linguistic detoxification, you said.
This is the highest level radioactive waste in the country. These are radioactive waste sludges in underground storage tanks of gigantic size in Hanford, Washington, for example. There's 177 of these tanks, and they hold a volume of 1 million gallons or more of high-level radioactive waste. Some of it is in liquid form, and some of it has settled to the bottom of these tanks as sludges. And yes, it's difficult to get the sludges out, but they are highly radioactive. And so what the Department of Energy has decided to do is to simply change their designation. And under law, they have to get high-level waste out. It has to go to a deep geologic repository. And what happened in 2004, which was so reprehensible, was that Lindsey Graham doomed future generations of his constituents to massive exposure to radioactive contamination, because at Savannah River Site, where this process is already underway, they have grouted with concrete cement into these storage tanks the high-level radioactive waste sludges in certain of the tanks. They can't reverse it now. It's irreparable what they've done. And so give it a couple hundred years and those tanks are going to fail. They're made of steel. They rust. And they will release at least a portion of the sludges into things like the Savannah River, the Tuscaloosa Aquifer. And they're going to doom downstream communities. The river water will be unfit for human consumption under the Safe Drinking Water Act, just in terms of strontium-90 releases. If 10% of the strontium-90 gets out of the tanks, it will poison the river. And so places like Hilton Head, places like Myrtle Beach are downstream. You'd think that people would care, but they don't even know. And that was Lindsey Graham who did that. And now they're trying to do the same thing in Hanford, Washington. And there's tremendous pushback. I mentioned we had 76 groups on short notice who signed on to this request for more time to comment. So they're putting the Columbia River at risk if they do this. They're at West Valley, New York, another reprocessing facility. They're putting Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, and the St. Lawrence Seaway at risk. Millions of people draw their drinking water from those Great Lakes.
What I think is so outrageous here is that this, I mean, there have got to be standards for this, right? Like, you can't just change something linguistically from one category to another. Like, what standards are around kind of what category of radioactive waste you can label something? There've got to be like some parts per million or some sort of measurement that would require a higher standard for some of the most highly radioactive waste in the country, right?
The laws have been very clear on this for many decades, that irradiated nuclear fuel, whether it's from the commercial nuclear power industry or from the nuclear weapons complex or research reactors, is high-level radioactive waste. And so too, and this is the relevance here for Hanford, Washington, West Valley, New York, reprocessed high-level radioactive waste. When you extract the plutonium to put into bombs, like they've done at Hanford for many decades, that leftover liquid and sludge waste product is high-level radioactive waste, also requiring deep geologic disposal. And Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, an attorney there named Jeff Fettis, who's their senior nuclear litigator, when the Department of Energy tried to do this Orwellian move at Idaho National Laboratory, he beat them in court. And then what happened in 2004? The Department of Energy has congressional lobbyists. They call them liaison. Well, they went up to Capitol Hill and they worked with Senator Lindsey Graham and they said, hey, could you change the law and allow us to simply deregulate these high-level radioactive waste sludges? And that's what happened. He attached it as a rider to a Defense Authorization Act in committee, a bill that's going to pass. And we tried to stop it on the Senate floor. And Maria Cantwell from Washington State was our champion because she's trying to defend her constituents downstream of Hanford. We managed to stop application at Hanford, Washington and West Valley, New York, but we lost in South Carolina and in Idaho. And so the fight is back on.
That's the voice of Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can go to their website, beyondnuclear.org, to read more about the group and what Kevin is talking about today and talks about every Wednesday here at Loud and Clear in this segment called Beyond Nuclear. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Nicole, go ahead. You were about to jump in.
The details of this are where it gets completely outrageous. I mean, so effectively what has happened is, you know, the court system, which has not always been the people's savior, but sometimes with enough litigation and with enough people pushing and with, you know, a bad enough scenario, you can get a win like NRDC did, right? But then lobbyists and money was able to just go in and with, you know, one of the legislators we've seen on TV quite a bit over the last year, Lindsey Graham, they're able to completely overwrite any of the necessary standards for something that's so incredibly dangerous. That's, going to affect these lobbyists' children and their children.
Yeah, and it's incredible that they got away with it at Savannah Riverside, South Carolina. I mentioned Myrtle Beach and Hilton Head. Some of the priciest real estate in the country is downstream of these shenanigans, and the clock is now ticking. Granted, it may take centuries, or the containers could leak quicker than that, but it's inevitable now that there will be massive radioactive releases into the Savannah River and into the Tuscaloosa Aquifer. Out in Idaho, it's into the Snake River and the Snake River Aquifer. As soon as they lock these radioactive sludges in place with this concrete grout, making it irreversible, and we're still just trying to stop, you know, the poisoning of West Valley, New York, for example. If they were to simply abandon these high-level radioactive waste sludges at West Valley, that entire site is going to erode into Lake Erie. It may take 1,000 years, but it's a highly eroding site, and that whole contamination will go into Lake Erie, flow into Lake Ontario, flow down river in the St. Lawrence, and poison the drinking water supply.
One other thing I wanted to point to, since we had you go into the details on the story, is the mechanism for this, right, was a rider. This was just an addendum onto a massive bill, the defense spending bills that Congress passes with, you know, very limited, sometimes no opposition to these massive spending bills. So this item that, you know, media doesn't write that much about nuclear waste, doesn't write that much about nuclear energy, doesn't write that much about this kind of waste issue. So this item that's so incredibly important was added, you know, as an afterthought that no one read, I'm sure, onto this massive bill. And that's how it was passed. That's how our legislation works. That's how our laws are made.
And what was so heartbreaking was we worked our butts off on very short notice to try to stop this in 2004. And we turned 3 Republicans. We got McCain of Arizona, which was a real miracle because he's so close to Lindsey Graham, politically, personally. But we turned him. We got Specter from Pennsylvania because of the effects on Lake Erie. And we got a Republican, Smith, out in Oregon, downstream of Hanford. But what was heartbreaking was John Kerry was out campaigning to become president that year. He missed the vote. So did John Edwards. And so did Max Baucus, who was recovering from heart surgery. So I guess we'll forgive him. But we should have won that vote, but 3 Democrats didn't show up for it.
It says a lot about the tortured nature of American democracy that you have grassroots lobbyists going around recruiting, winning over, educating, however you want to put it, a number of senators and succeeding. Getting the votes to win.
Because the facts are so strong. It's so clear.
Yeah. It's just clearly rational. And the other way is clearly irrational and dangerous. So you feel victory is at hand. And then a couple people miss a vote because they're out engaged in self-promotion, like running for president or doing whatever. And then there's somebody like Lindsey Graham, the snake in the grass for the people of South Carolina, actually able to attach it as a rider, which for everyone to fully understand, it's an amendment to the defense spending bill. And all of the senators passed the defense spending bill because none of them want to appear to be weak on defense. So the bill is going to go through. So as an amendment, they tag it on. Lindsey Graham tags it on and it becomes the law, And then the people in South Carolina at some point, and the people in other states at some point will have their communities destroyed, the lives of, if not them, their progeny down the line destroyed. I mean, it really says a lot about the way our democracy works.
And to show how absurd this law change was, the way it's written, if that high-level radioactive waste sludge were to cross the border into Georgia, and the Savannah River site is on the border of South Carolina and Georgia, it would return to high-level radioactive waste status. So I guess as it leaks out of its container over time and it hits that far bank of the Savannah River, it'll magically become high-level radioactive waste again, and maybe they'll clean it up once it's leaked. I don't think so.
That absolutely says it all.
Again, for our audience, linguistic detoxification does not exist.
Nope.
You can change the words. You can call arsenic something else, but if you drink it, it's still arsenic and you'll know it right away. I mean, it doesn't exist. But this, in fact, they're playing word games with the regulations. Let's, again, tell our audience, because time is of the essence. It's a very short comment period. Kevin Camps, tell people why the comment period matters and how they make a comment and the kind of importance of the diversity of comments so that it's not 10,000 people saying this is a bad idea and thus the government can write it off as just one big omnibus comment.
Yeah, I'll get this on our homepage, which is www.beyondnuclear.org, ways that listeners can make comments. So the power of comments is they're very hard won, this process of being allowed to make a public comment. And it can, in itself, if you get enough comments, cause an agency to change course if they see that enough people are paying attention. Another benefit is that if we do go to court to try to stop this legally, then we've got those comments backing us up. The courts will see that. It's also required for legal standing that you've taken every administrative opportunity to take part. And so that's the importance. And like I said, we have 76 groups already engaged in this, a lot of them downstream of Hanford, downstream of West Valley. And so watch for that on the website. It'll show you how to make your own comment.
Beyond Nuclear has been doing these sorts of comment collection drives and this kind of organizing work for a very long time. And you guys have really had wins with that kind of work.
You know, I just to emphasize this again for people who are listening to our show, why this is critically important. Last year, I think it was last year, or maybe it was the year before, the National Park Service tried to introduce new regulations to charge higher fees to go to public parks, you know, the parks that people camp in or go hiking in. There were so many comments that the National Park Service had to retract it. Now, the National Park Service is introducing new regulations under the Trump administration to make it very hard and in some cases impossible to demonstrate in Washington, D.C. The Trump administration is doing that because they don't want people to demonstrate in Washington, D.C. for the obvious reason. In the last couple months, I'm part of the Answer Coalition. We endorsed an initiative from the Partnership for Civil Justice and many other legal and civil rights groups to try to make comments about the NPS regulation change, proposed regulation change about demonstrating. In a week's time, within a week, the last week when the deadline was right upon us, we had so much support. There was so much of a coalition, like you have 76 groups. We were able to get 160,000 comments in the last week alone where people put their message in. That, as you said, Kevin Kamps, becomes part of the legal record. So if the agencies go forward and against public opinion, against the public will, try to do it, there's litigation. The litigation relies on the comments for the public record, correct?
Yeah, and those are great numbers you just cited. I mean, we've set records recently in the Waste Control Specialist Texas Centralized Interim Storage Facility fight with 40,000 plus comments. So you can see that we have a long way to go, waking people up, expanding our networks, getting the word out. But when we can show up with 76 groups on a public comment proceeding like this, that really represent millions of members nationwide. That's the power of the anti-nuclear movement.
Moving on to another topic where you all also have a lot of groups working towards this is the Yucca Mountain dump. I know y'all are expecting end of year legislation. And I just wanted to hear a little bit more about what's going on in this fight. It seems like, especially if it's end of year legislation, one of the big arguments against approving this Yucca Mountain dump that has been, you know, litigated and controversial for quite some time is that there's no reason to rush this. This is a long process. This is an important decision. Why are we slamming this through at the end of the year? But tell us a little bit more about the technical reasons why this is a bad idea.
Well, one figure is that it's well over 1,000 environmental groups, environmental justice groups that have taken a stand against the Yucca Mountain dump over the course of decades, because we've been fighting it since at least 1987 when the Screw Nevada bill was passed into law, singling out Yucca Mountain on Western Shoshone Indian land as the only site in the country to be further considered for a high-level radioactive waste dump. So that said, our most recent, you know, battle, we had 61 groups show up saying, don't even think about trying to fund Yucca licensing before the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on another rider in this omnibus funding bill that's coming together to try to avert a government shutdown beginning on December 21st. And so we're just beating that drum that's gone on for decades saying, don't even think about it. But we've got House Republicans, especially like Simpson from Idaho, who's chair of the Energy and Water Appropriations Subcommittee, who's pushing for it. And so we have to keep showing up vigilantly to stop them from getting away with it. Shimkus from Illinois, Republican subcommittee chair, who's been pushing bad legislation to expand the amount of waste that could be buried at Yucca, expedite the process of opening the dump in the first place. So we've got our work cut out for us, even at Yucca. And you asked about the technical reasons. It's an earthquake zone. It's a volcanic zone. It's a seismic zone. It's supersaturated with water underground. And so the perfect storm of corrosion will be created if waste is ever buried there, and you would have expedited, accelerated release of high-level radioactive waste into the groundwater to flow downstream to poison an agricultural community called Amargosa Valley, Nevada, and a Western Shoshone band called the Timbisha in Death Valley with massive doses of radiation if Yucca were to ever open.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. She's also a Sputnik News analyst. And we're joined, as we are every Wednesday, by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website, beyondnuclear.org.
I was reading one of the letters that this kind of really long list of groups opposing Yucca wrote and got into Congress. And I thought one really interesting piece of it was that the NRC has technically approved these plans for limited purposes, just to kind of look at and review this potential license, but that there are a ton of plans that aren't actually finalized yet. So one example was something called a drip shield. So these are drip shields that are supposed to sit over these waste canisters. There hasn't been a plan to design them, to license them, to pay for them, to budget for them, to install them. And, you know, the current write-up, those would happen in the next 100 years. But those are necessary, you know, to be able to qualify for NRC standard. So essentially, this is like a half-written plan that wouldn't actually, you know, qualify for the standards that we need to be able to store this really dangerous waste. It's just, after these decades of fighting, it's still not even like a plan that makes any sense.
Because Yucca Mountain was chosen for raw political reasons, despite its scientific and other unsuitability, the titanium drip shields are a Hail Mary pass by the Department of Energy to keep the site under consideration. What they would do is they would cover the waste burial containers to prevent the dripping water from the ceilings of the tunnels from corroding those waste burial containers very quickly. So they're going to create, you know, a dense metallic shield at huge expense, billions of dollars, that won't be installed until 100 years after the waste is emplaced in the mountain. And like you said, it's not even designed. And what that means is they're never going to do it. It's just a fig leaf. And when it comes time to install them, what they're going to find is the tunnels will have collapsed in significant part, and they won't be able to install the drip shield. So they're just putting it out there as, just trust us, we're going to make sure that the water flow doesn't hit the waste burial containers. We're going to put these shields in. They're never going to do it. That would all have to be done remotely because the radioactivity levels would be so high in those tunnels. And when they encounter the rock fall, their robotic systems are not going to be able to overcome that. So, I went to a technical meeting at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission one time, and they don't expect people to attend these meetings. And one of their scientists, their engineers, said, hey, look, you know, if the rock fall is too significant and we can't overcome it technically by engineering design, we'll just assume smaller boulders. So if you can assume away the problem.
That's called a linguistically modified boulder.
Yeah. They didn't think anybody was there to listen to this being said out loud. And, you know, hey, we'll just assume away the problems, and who cares what's going to happen 100 years from now underground at Yucca Mountain? Who cares what's going to happen 200 years from now downstream of the Savannah River site in South Carolina? Well, a lot of people do. A lot of people care about their descendants, and the powers that be in the nuclear establishment do not, and they try to keep people in the dark.
This is yet another theme here and another subject where this should be a policy decision. This should be a decision for, you know, the descendants on this planet. This should be a decision for the people who live in these communities, but it's just a political decision instead.
Yeah. What's happening now is the future is being determined now. People, politicians, and corporate interests are determining the future because what they do now will impact the future, perhaps in an irreversible way. So the future is not the future. The future is the present. That's how people need to think about this and act with that kind of urgency.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes is from Einstein in 1946. He said, "The splitting of the atom has changed everything except for our way of thinking, and thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe." And he was speaking in the context of nuclear weapons, but it very much applies to radioactive waste, for example. And what's really ironic about some of these stories like West Valley, New York, is that the immediate downstream neighbors are the Seneca Indian tribe, whose reservation is right downstream of this leaking site, this eroding site. And the Seneca are a member tribe of the Iroquois, the Haudenosaunee, whose seventh generation philosophy is so famous that every decision we make has to account for what it means for the seventh generation down the road in the future. Except with, you know, plutonium, for example, it's not seven generations, it's 12,000 generations. That's how long the hazard is going to last. So at Yucca Mountain, Nevada, it's the Western Shoshone Indians who are downstream. you know, this is a native continent. And a lot of these sites were chosen because of their remoteness, and maybe there was a native tribe down the road that nobody cared about when the decision was made to locate these facilities.
The 12,000th generation.
Yeah, the hazard of plutonium-239 is a 24,000-year half-life, and you have to multiply the half-life by at least 10, if not 20, to get into the safe period. So that's 24,000 times 10, 240,000 years. You
know, the human species exists because as we grew as a species, people learned from their mistakes. They learned, hey, eating this thing might kill us if it's not cooked. Eating these berries are toxic and they'll kill us, so let's not eat them. All sorts of prohibitions, including legal codes and religious codes, were designed to protect people from doing things that would be harmful to them. We learn by our mistakes. There's no other way evolution actually goes forward, because if we were unable to adapt and learn, we would be finished. But the technology here is of a qualitatively different character, because even if we learn sometime in the next four generations or five generations, it becomes irreversible for, as you put it, the next 12,000 generations. So we're dealing with problem solving, the kind of problem solving that humans have always had to do, but with a technology that makes it so far different. The realm is so, the magnitude is so far different that our capacity to learn and to adjust and to adapt, it won't matter. I mean, you can't rely on technology in 100 years or 200 years to get rid of this stuff, because as you said in the beginning, ultimately the caskets are going to erode. There's going to be degeneration. There's going to be leakages, and it's going to be the land and it's going to be the water.
Another big story from the past week is that the state of Vermont, its Public Utilities Commission, and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission have both approved the takeover of the Vermont Yankee shutdown reactor site by a private company, North Star, which is a consortium of waste control specialists of Texas and Areva of France and some other companies. And it's the same danger that you just described, Brian. This company has a profit motive. There is a $500 million nuclear decommissioning trust fund available to work with to dismantle the facility, to clean up the radioactive contamination. And they shouldn't use this trust fund for this, but they are, with NRC approval, to manage the high-level radioactive waste. Those are supposed to be other monies. So they're actually robbing the trust fund for cleanup in order to manage the high-level radioactive waste. So that same dynamic of, you know, maximizing profits by not cleaning up, by simply pocketing the money, calling it good enough, and then walking away, that's going to put people downstream, downwind at Vermont Yankee, that's on the Connecticut River, at risk. And so, unfortunately, government bodies have signed off on this. We're fighting aspects of it, and there's watchdogs in Vermont, in Massachusetts, watching every turn. The part that we're engaged in is the centralized interim storage facility in Texas, where they want to move the high-level radioactive waste for temporary so-called storage. So we're fighting that as we speak.
That's Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. We're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Time is going fast, Nicole.
Time is going fast, and there's a couple of really interesting stories kind of halfway around the world. We've got about 3 minutes, and I wanted to hear from both of you about Korean border troops verifying removal of each other's posts. So border troops on both South Korea and in North Korea are meeting. They're, you know, exchanging, the article I read said even exchanging cigarettes. They're walking around kind of removing some of these posts, which seems like a really great sign, a really great step forward in trying to denuclearize the peninsula.
You know what it reminds me of is when the U.S. and Soviet armies met on the Elbe River. And what did they do? They partied. The war was over. They were
1945.
Yes. And it also reminds me of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, now Russia, where inspections were a huge part of that. And now Trump wants to do away with the treaty. It was probably the best ever establishment of inspections between adversaries that was ever achieved under nuclear diplomacy. And now Trump just wants to trash the treaty.
Of course, the DMZ, which stands for Demilitarized Zone at the 38th parallel separating North and South Korea, is not demilitarized. It's, in fact, the most militarized part of the planet. Wildlife has thrived as a consequence of the fact that humans have had to stay away. It's been a real wildlife sanctuary. But it's still very, very dangerous because it has been so militarized. Of course, what's at stake right now, or what's on the agenda is a better way of putting it, is whether or not nuclear weapons will ultimately be banned from the Korean Peninsula. North Korea said at the Singapore summit that they're ready to engage in a process for denuclearization. But what they mean by that is get rid of nuclear weapons in their totality, not just North Korean nuclear weapons. A promising development, but one that faces a lot of hurdles.
Well, the American hypocrisy that comes to my mind is that the Secretary of State, Pompeo, is all up in arms about Russian nuclear-capable bombers landing in Venezuela. But of course, the United States plays that game over the Korean Peninsula on a fairly regular basis, with nuclear-capable bombers being flown around as a show of strength, so-called. So the hypocrisy is kind of thick.
Absolutely. And there's two other kind of interesting pieces going on.
You have to do that in 20 seconds.
The U.S. has now warned South Korea that they will have workers furloughed if South Korea doesn't start paying more. But the problem is the workers we're talking about are essentially there to take care of American troops. So America is asking South Korea to fund the people taking care of America's troops that are posted in South Korea. I probably don't have time to go to the second one, so I won't.
That's called irrational, militaristic detoxification language. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We were joined, as we are every Wednesday, by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website, beyondnuclear.org. Be sure to make your comment, as we talked about in this segment. And we're also joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a producer of this show and a Sputnik news analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.